Books on Tape presents Absalom, Absalom by William Faulkner. Read by Grover Gardner. Chapter 1. From a little after 2 o'clock until almost sundown of the long, still, hot, weary, dead September afternoon, they sat in what Miss Coldfield still called the office, because her father had called it that. A dim, hot, airless room with the blinds all closed and fastened for 43 summers, because when she was a girl, someone had believed that light and moving air carried heat, and that dark was always cooler, and which, as the sun shone fuller and fuller on that side of the house, became latticed with yellow slashes full of dust motes, which Quentin thought of as being flecks of the dead old dried paint itself blown inward from the scaling blinds, as wind might have blown them. There was a wisteria vine blooming for the second time that summer on a wooden trellis before one window, into which sparrows came now and then in random gusts, making a dry, vivid, dusty sound before going away. And opposite Quentin, Miss Coldfield, in the eternal black, which she had worn for 43 years now, whether for sister, father, or not husband, none knew, sitting so bolt upright in the straight, hard chair that was so tall for her that her legs hung straight and rigid as if she had iron shin bones and ankles, clear of the floor with that air of impotent and static rage like children's feet, and talking in that grim, haggard, amazed voice until at last listening would renege and hearing sense self-confound, and the long-dead object of her impotent yet indomitable frustration would appear, as though by outraged recapitulation evoked, quiet, inattentive, and harmless, out of the biding and dreamy and victorious dust. Her voice would not cease, it would just vanish. There would be the dim coffin-smelling gloom, sweet and oversweet, with the twice-bloomed wisteria against the outer wall by the savage, quiet September sun impacted, distilled, and hyper-distilled, into which came now and then the loud, cloudy flutter of the sparrows like a flat limber stick whipped by an idle boy, and the rank smell of female old flesh long embattled in virginity, while the wan, haggard face watched him above the faint triangle of lace at wrists and throat from the too tall chair in which she resembled a crucified child. And the voice not ceasing, but vanishing into and then out of the long intervals like a stream, a trickle running from patch to patch of dried sand. And the ghost mused with shadowy docility as if it were the voice which he haunted, where a more fortunate one would have had a house. Out of quiet thunderclap he would abrupt, man, horse, demon, upon a scene peaceful and decorous as a school prize watercolor, faint sulphur reek still in hair, clothes, and beard, with grouped behind him his band of wild niggers like beasts half-tamed to walk upright like men, in attitudes wild and reposed, and manacled among them the French architect with his air grim, haggard, and tataran. Immobile, bearded, and hand palm lifted, the horseman sat. Behind him the wild blacks and the captive architect huddled quietly, carrying in bloodless paradox the shovels and picks and axes of peaceful conquest. Then in the long unamaze, Quentin seemed to watch them overrun suddenly the 100 square miles of tranquil and astonished earth and drag house and formal gardens violently out of the soundless nothing, and clapped them down like cards upon a table beneath the up-palm, immobile and pontific, creating the Sutpen's Hundred, the Bee Sutpen's Hundred, like the olden-time Bee Light. Then hearing would reconcile, and he would seem to listen to 2 separate Quentins now, the Quentin Compson preparing for Harvard in the South, the Deep South, dead since 1865, and peopled with garrulous, outraged, baffled ghosts, listening, having to listen, to one of the ghosts which had refused to lie still even longer than most had, telling him about old ghost times. And the Quentin Compson who was still too young to deserve yet to be a ghost, but nevertheless having to be one for all that, since he was born and bred in the Deep South the same as she was. The 2 separate Quentins now talking to one another in the long silence of not people in not language, like this. It seems that this demon, his name was Sutpen, Colonel Sutpen, who came out of nowhere and without warning upon the land with a band of strange niggers and built a plantation, tore violently a plantation, Miss Rosa Coldfield says, tore violently, and married her sister Ellen and begot a son and a daughter which, without gentleness begot, Miss Rosa Coldfield says, without gentleness, which should have been the jewels of his pride and the shield and comfort of his old age only. Only they destroyed him or something, or he destroyed them or something, and died. And died. Without regret, Miss Rosa Coldfield says. Save by her. Yes, save by her. And by Quentin Compson. Yes, and by Quentin Compson. Because you are going away to attend the college at Harvard, they tell me, she said. So I don't imagine you will ever come back here and settle down as a country lawyer in a little town like Jefferson, since northern people have already seen to it that there is little left in the South for a young man. So maybe you will enter the literary profession, as so many southern gentlemen and gentlewomen too are doing now, and maybe some day you will remember this and write about it. You will be married then, I expect, and perhaps your wife will want a new gown or a new chair for the house, and you can write this and submit it to the magazines. Perhaps you will even remember kindly then the old woman who made you spend a whole afternoon sitting indoors and listening while she talked about people and events you were fortunate enough to escape yourself, when you wanted to be out among young friends of your own age. Yes'm, Quentin said. Only she don't mean that, he thought. It's because she wants it told. It was still early then. He had yet in his pocket the note which he had received by the hand of a small negro boy just before noon, asking him to call and see her, the quaint, stiffly formal request which was actually a summons out of another world almost. The queer, archaic sheet of ancient good notepaper written over with the neat, faded, cramped script which, due to his astonishment at the request from a woman three times his age and whom he had known all his life without having exchanged 100 words with her, or perhaps to the fact that he was only 20 years old, he did not recognize as revealing a character cold, implacable, and even ruthless. He obeyed it immediately after the noon meal, walking the half-mile between his home and hers through the dry, dusty heat of early September, and so into the house. It, too, somehow smaller than its actual size, it was of 2 stories, unpainted and a little shabby, yet with an air, a quality, of grim endurance, as though, like her, it had been created to fit into and complement a world in all ways a little smaller than the one in which it found itself. Where in the gloom of the shuttered hallway, whose air was even hotter than outside, as if there were prisoned in it like in a tomb all the suspiration of slow, heat-laden time which had recurred during the 43 years, the small figure in black, which did not even rustle, the wan triangle of lace at wrists and throat, the dim face looking at him with an expression speculative, urgent, and intent, waited to invite him in. It's because she wants it told, he thought, so that people whom she will never see and whose names she will never hear, and who have never heard her name nor seen her face, will read it and know at last why God let us lose the war. That only through the blood of our men and the tears of our women could he stay this demon and efface his name and lineage from the earth. Then, almost immediately, he decided that neither was this the reason why she had sent the note, and sending it, why to him? Since, if she had merely wanted it told, written and even printed, she would not have needed to call in anybody. A woman who even in his, Quentin's, father's youth had already established, even if not affirmed, herself, as the town's and the county's poetess laureate, by issuing to the stern and meager subscription list of the county newspaper poems, ode, eulogy, and epitaph, out of some bitter and implacable reserve of undefeat. And these from a woman whose family's martial background, as both town and county knew, consisted of the father who, a conscientious objector on religious grounds, had starved to death in the attic of his own house, hidden, some said walled up, there, from Confederate Provost Marshal's men and fed secretly at night by this same daughter, who at the very time was accumulating her first folio in which the lost causes unregenerate vanquished were name by name embalmed. And the nephew, who served for 4 years in the same company with his sister's fiancé, and then shot the fiancé to death before the gates to the house where the sister waited in her wedding gown on the eve of the wedding, and then fled, vanished, none knew where. It would be 3 hours yet before he would learn why she had sent for him, because this part of it, this first part of it, Quentin already knew. It was a part of his 20 years' heritage of breathing the same air and hearing his father talk about the man. A part of the town's, Jefferson's,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?